The Guardian.
Another week, another U-turn from a Tory government with a tin ear. I'm Jonathan Friedland, columnist at The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
I talked to Marcus Rashford today and congratulated him on his campaign, in which, to be honest, I only became aware of very recently today. And I thank him for what he's done. I think he's right to draw attention.
After the Manchester United striker Marcus Rashford wrote a powerful and personal letter to MPs urging them to extend free school meals for the poorest families in England over the summer, Boris Johnson originally rejected his plea. But a wave of public backing for Rashford and unrest on the Tory backbenches forced the Prime Minister's hand. And on Tuesday, the government announced it would, after all, extend the programme that helps prevent thousands of children from going hungry every day. But why did it take Man U's number 10 to get number 10 to do the right thing? If not morally, then at least in terms of basic politics, how did Johnson's Downing Street operation allow themselves to be on the wrong side of a new national hero and a national consensus? It was obvious they'd have to U-turn eventually, so why did they hold out so long? We'll talk about all of that and ask if, despite its 80-strong majority, this is a government that can be pushed around, one that caves in rather easily. In the midst of the Rashford row, the government did a bit of restructuring, announcing that the Department for International Development will be no more, its role swallowed up by the Foreign Office. Critics are calling the move nothing more than a distraction, or perhaps a bit more culture war games designed to wind up Liberals. Are they right? With everything else going on at the moment, fighting a global pandemic, is now really the time to reorganise Whitehall? We'll talk about it. And I'll be speaking to Jonathan Ashworth, the man Keir Starmer kept on as Labour's Shadow Health and Social Care Secretary, despite Ashworth endorsing Starmer's rival, Lisa Nandy, for the party leadership. We'll discuss the role he thinks Labour should be playing in the battle against coronavirus and what he makes of Labour's new leader compared to the old one. Plus, with only 6 months to go before the UK leaves the EU, Lisa O'Carroll gives us an update on the latest Brexit negotiations. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, if you were looking for a quiet week in politics, look elsewhere, because it's been all go at Westminster. And to discuss it, I'm joined virtually and down the line by The Guardian's Francis Perraudin. Francis, very good to have you back on. It's proving to be rather a busy week. As we record now, it's just after we've both watched Prime Minister's Questions. Let's have a bit of that.
I want kids to go back to school. The unions won't let him say the truth. Which is that schools, a great ox has stood upon his tongue, Mr. Speaker. Let him now say that schools are safe to go back to.
This is turning into opposition questions. If the Prime Minister, if the Prime Minister wants to swap places, I'm very happy. We could do it now.
It was quite the rowdy performance from both sides. Boris Johnson seemed to have an agenda going into this session, which was to get Keir Starmer on the back foot, on the defensive. It looked as if perhaps it was an attempt to somehow shift the blame and deflect attention onto the opposition. How did Keir Starmer respond to it? And for your money, did that work as an approach for Boris Johnson?
I don't think it will go down as one of Starmer's best PMQs. His decision was basically to ignore it. Just as Johnson was ignoring questions from him, he then decided to deflect questions from Johnson, and it was quite a monotonous scene. But I was quite surprised he didn't have an answer ready on that. Seema Malhotra, the Shadow Employment Minister, was on the BBC straight after, and she did kind of clarify Labour's line, which is reasonably nuanced, which is that parents should send their children back to school if they have confidence that the school in question is safe. And the same can go for teachers as well, that those teachers need to be persuaded that they will be safe if they go back to work.
Yeah, I found it an odd that Keir Starmer wasn't able to think more quickly on his feet and come up with just something. So he appeared at least to be answering the question. And I thought there was a very easy way out of this, which was, it depends. It depends if they're safe,
yeah,
depending on what the school has done, what the local authority has done, and whether parents are confident. Now, it's not often that football and politics share the front and back pages, but that has happened this week. Our colleague Marina Hyde wrote on Tuesday, so we are left with a 22-year-old footballer having to point out the realities to men whose job it is supposed to be to know. Why did the government have to be, in effect, forced by this extremely high-profile and rather brilliant campaigner, Marcus Rashford, to change their mind on the issue of keeping children in England fed through the summer holidays?
I think it was because of a number of factors. I think that the government thought last week after PMQs, when they were asked about this issue and they said that they would commit £63 million to councils to feed children over the school holidays, I think they thought that that was that. I think that then Rashford's intervention was so effective because he really is believably non-party political. He kept on saying that his call on the government to continue to provide these vouchers was not aligned to any party, and it was very believable. I think that another factor was actually that Labour has played very clever politics with this, and their decision yesterday to hold this Opposition Day debate on the subject, basically forcing Tory MPs to vote to deny children meals during school holidays. I thought that was very clever, and the government in the end were facing the prospect of, I mean, they do have an 80 strong majority, so they probably wouldn't have lost the vote, but lots of reports in today's papers about MPs, Tory MPs, saying that they couldn't possibly vote against this proposal by the Labour Party.
The question I think a lot of people you pick up on Tory benches are asking themselves is how on earth did this supposedly, you know, crack force in Downing Street of political geniuses misread the public's mood on this? I mean, starting with Boris Johnson himself, who prides himself as having this kind of connection with the British people, which saw him won that big election. And then, of course, Dominic Cummings, who's meant to have such a sort of almost magical feel for the soul of the British people. You don't want to be on the opposite side of Marcus Rashford and poor children.
It was astonishingly badly handled from them, and lots of evidence today that there's even if this doesn't kind of end up running as a news story for many more days, I think that it has caused a further damage to the way Dominic Cummings is seen by already quite disgruntled Tory MPs. I think it was Nicholas Watt on Newsnight saying that he had spoken to lots of Tory MPs and Dominic Cummings was coming up unprompted. So Conservative backbenchers who are already kind of at their wits' end with this guy after the Durham scandal, this is yet another black mark against his name.
Very much, in the sense that the sort of curtain has been pulled back and the Wizard of Oz is not really all that. Well, what about this question of U-turns, though? Keir Starmer did go on this and mentioned that there have now been three. The government have backed down now. How does that now play out? Will they be more wary to back down because people will start saying, there they go again, they keep U-turning? Or would their sort of confidence be shaken so that they actually end up reversing themselves more often? How do you think that plays out?
I suspect that they will go to very long lengths not to have to make another U-turn anytime soon. In PMQs today, when Starmer hit him with the kind of allegation that you have had three U-turns in 4 weeks? That is pretty powerful, especially since we are going through a global pandemic and we need competent government more than ever. So it does just look terrible.
That's right. Let's talk about this other move that Boris Johnson made in this completely jam-packed Tuesday, which was his announcement that he would create a new international department by merging the Department for International Development with the Foreign Office to create a new Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office, which I think at least one of our colleagues remarked is FCD off for short. Before we get into why this might be bad move substantively. What do you think was the reason for making the move at all and for making it now?
The reason he gave for making the move, I think he used this term about how UK overseas aid had been treated like a giant cash point in the sky and was being given out without reference to UK interests. The other argument that's given is that it kind of rationalises a very big, unwieldy part of Whitehall, where there's lots of duplication between the Foreign Office and DFID. Whether or not that's true, I mean, it's a matter for debate, but it doesn't seem like the time to be embarking on a four-month reorganisation of a big section of the civil service.
And so why do you think they did announce it now? Some people have wondered if it was a diversion.
It doesn't really make sense why they would announce it now. I think diversion, possibly. Also, the other thing is we've known for a long time that this was something that Johnson and Cummings were very keen on. And by doing it now, it also means that the quite kind of powerful voices in overseas aid who are very critical, that will all be submerged in the coronavirus crisis. So we will hear much less criticism of this move than we would have done had they done it at almost any other time, because there's just bigger news to be focusing on at the moment.
It's been a packed week already, and one of the things it was packed with was this appointment by Boris Johnson of Munira Mirza, his advisor in Number 10, to head up a new government inquiry into racial inequalities. The problem, critics say, is that Mirza is on the record saying that she doesn't believe there's such thing as institutional racism, among a whole lot of other things she's written and said. Is it a very odd choice to head up an inquiry like this?
So the revelation that she was going to be in charge of establishing this commission did kind of surprise me, because I had been, I'm going to say this cautiously, pleasantly surprised at some of the statements that Johnson made, because we'd heard all about Black Lives Matter and the protest, because we'd seen so much evidence that they were about to embark on this culture war stuff again. Then he came out and gave a statement where he said that people of colour do face structural inequalities, and said to these protesters, "I hear you." And it really did feel for a very small moment like maybe their approach was just going to be quite kind of straightforward and open and say, "I hear you," and then set up a commission. But then the appointment of Mirza, back to the drawing board.
Frances Perrodin, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Now, we've been talking of U-turns, but anyone, including in Brussels, who is hoping that the UK government might cave in and ask for an extension to the EU transition period, was sorely disappointed at the end of last week. That's when the EU said that they now accept that the UK will in fact take the country out of the EU on the 31st of December as planned. Of course, if the past is any guide, Brexit deadlines are made to be broken. But how will this firm line from London affect the negotiations between the two sides? Can the EU and the UK force themselves to make a deal in 6 months against a backdrop of a global health and economic crisis? The Guardian's Brexit correspondent, Lisa O'Carroll, has this report.
We noted the UK's decision not to request any extension to the transition period. The transition period will therefore end on the 31st of December 2020, in line with the provisions of the withdrawal agreement.
Well, the EU gave its more or less formal answer to the UK's decision not to request an extension to the transition period on Monday, at a meeting between Boris Johnson and the presidents of the Commission, European Council and the Parliament. It wasn't a surprise. It was more or less a formality, because from the get-go, right from January, the British government have been saying that they wouldn't request an extension, as they were entitled to do legally, up to the 30th of June. But listeners might remember that in January, a law was passed, in fact, to prevent anybody seeking an extension to the transition period. And then when COVID came along, I think many people felt that it would be a disaster if there wasn't an extension. But the government have stuck to their guns. It's fairly black and white. The extension opportunity is there up to June the 30th, and it's not going to be exercised.
Some argue that we must accept EU procedures as the benchmark because of the scale of UK trade with the EU. But the volume of UK trade with the EU is no greater than the volume of US trade with the EU. And the EU was more than willing to offer zero tariff access to the US without the application of EU procedures to US standard setting.
There are big trade consequences. We could be entering into a WTO, a World Trade Organization, trading environment, which would mean tariffs in both directions. It would mean customs declarations would be required on either side, come what may, because Britain is leaving the customs union, the European Customs Union. And with that comes the potential for severe disruption to trade. And coming on top of the coronavirus pandemic, business leaders have said that the government is just going to kill businesses that are already struggling. The government has responded to that. And last week, Michael Gove announced that they're going to delay the customs and regulatory checks that they intend to do on the border until July next year. But that doesn't mean there won't be checks on the EU side. The EU have responded and saying they will be imposing customs and regulatory checks on the EU side from January next year. So the consequences are fairly serious for those people who rely on imports and exports for their supply chain.
We supported the plans agreed by chief negotiators to intensify the talks in July and to create the most conducive conditions for concluding and ratifying a deal before the end of 2020.
The meeting on Monday was a bit of a formality, the meeting between Johnson and the EU leaders, because it was decided quite some time ago, probably by round three last month, that the talks were going nowhere. So both sides had published their mandates for a negotiation in February and March, followed by legal texts. But before that, there was a political declaration that was agreed last year. And it was clear from the middle of the talks that Britain was not going to countenance any compromise on key areas such as the role of the European Court of Justice, fisheries, state aid, level playing field, etc. And on its part, the EU accused the UK of rowing back on virtually everything in the political declaration. By the time round four came along at the beginning of June, it was clear that the two sides were never going to meet in the middle.
As I said to the three presidents, put a tiger in the tank, because it's very clear what the UK needs and what our EU friends, I think, need to understand.
So now what is going to happen is they've agreed five more rounds of talks for July, but also, interestingly, the last week in August the 17th, has a round penciled in, plus potential for more meetings in September. So that's where we're going now. There's going to be a European Council summit meeting this week, but we're not expecting anything out of that, really. All eyes will be on what's going to happen in July and in August.
What we all really said today was that the faster we can do this, the better. And we see no reason why you shouldn't get that done in July.
And Boris Johnson was terribly optimistic after the hour-long meeting with EU leaders on Monday. But the clue is in the fact that the meeting was only an hour. There were six people at that meeting. But what we got out of that was another round of theatrics from Boris Johnson, telling us in TV clips that he did that there was no reason there shouldn't be a deal sealed in July. Now, those who are negotiating know that that's going to be pretty difficult. They haven't made progress in the first four rounds, and it will be very difficult to seal a deal in the four rounds in July. We also got to remember that they have been hampered by coronavirus. They haven't been able to have any meetings face to face, which means you don't get any of the informal conversations that you would get in the corridors, either in Brussels or in London. So the EU's take on the meeting on Monday was also upbeat, I have to say, but they are still sticking to this line that they are okay about doing a deal in September, in October. So their schedule, I think, is more realistic. And Boris Johnson, I think many have agreed, was speaking to a domestic audience.
That was The Guardian's Lisa O'Carroll. After the break, I speak to the Shadow Secretary of State for Health and Social Care, Jonathan Ashworth. We'll be back after this.
Welcome to Forgotten Stories of Football, a new podcast series from The Guardian. Each episode features a great story from the history of football you've probably never heard before. From the captain of France who murdered for Hitler, to the Sheffield Wednesday top scorer who acted with Charlie Chaplin, to the story of how primetime TV inspired one of the sport's most shambolic appointments with manager idol. Listen out for The Guardian's Forgotten Stories of Football. Make sure you subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Now, the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, has come in for plenty of criticism throughout this pandemic, faulted for telling us the government had succeeded when actually it failed to meet testing targets, and for demanding a Labour front bencher watch her tone after she dared question his handling of the crisis. But it's not just political commentators who are watching Hancock's every move. Jonathan Ashworth, Shadow Secretary for Health and Social Care, has been eyeballing him from across the chamber, albeit virtually for the most part. So how much interaction has Ashworth had with his opposite number these past few months? And looking to the top of his own party, how's he getting on under a leader he didn't originally back? I spoke to him earlier this week. He's one of the few members of the Shadow Cabinet to have served under both the current and former Labour leaders. So I started by asking, what differences has he noticed between the two men?
I think they're obviously politicians with a different approach to things, perhaps coming from different traditions in the Labour Party. I think, though, that Keir Starmer, since he became the leader of the Labour Party 2 months ago or so, has not put a foot wrong. I think he is rebuilding trust with the British people, and quite self-evidently, we lost the trust of the British people with that two general election defeats, sadly, under Jeremy. And I think that says something about Keir Starmer's approach and indeed ability, that at this time when coronavirus is generally dominated the news, I think for Keir Starmer to be able to capture the attention of the public in the way that he has, which is reflected in the opinion polls, I think is testament to his skill. All leaders have different approaches. All leaders have their strengths. All leaders have their weaknesses. All leaders chair meetings in different ways. I think that's just the nature of politics. But I think Keir has brought a very focused approach and a very disciplined approach to the way in which we're conducting ourselves.
We're talking down a line here, but I can even hear the glint in your eye as you say that, because I think what you're saying is it's functional now and it wasn't functional before.
Well, I think you're mischievously trying to put words in my mouth, Jonathan. I mean, yeah. I'm not trying to be, I'm not here to, Jeremy Corbyn, was leader of the Labour Party. He was strongly supported by a huge section of the Labour Party membership. And I'm not here to sort of knock Jeremy Corbyn. He gave me a tremendous opportunity by promoting me to be the Labour Party's Shadow Health spokesperson, a job I absolutely love and one that I want to convert into being the actual health spokesperson. So I'm not going to knock Jeremy Corbyn, but you can see in the opinion polls that Starmer is turning things around in the Labour Party and is rebuilding trust with the British people, and that can only be a good thing.
You yourself backed Lisa Nandy for the leadership. The one criticism that's been made of Keir Starmer is that has he, if anything, been sort of too gentle, too barrister-like and polite? This phrase of constructive opposition. Some worry, particularly as, and we're going to talk about this more, but as the coronavirus death toll rises, with Britain having either the highest, second highest or third highest per capita death rate in the world, that maybe he should have been angrier and, a bit less constructive and a bit more opposition.
I mean, when you look at the appalling death rates, it is pretty clear that the government's handling of this crisis has been slow, has been disorganised, that they've been playing catch-up. Now, of course, they were always going to make mistakes because this is in some ways an unprecedented crisis. But I think the question is, do they actually learn from those mistakes? I don't think they have. On saying that, though, I don't think it would help if Labour politicians were sort of shouting and screaming at the dispatch box. I think we need to be highlighting failures, but pressing the government to improve their response, because this is not like a sort of general election campaign where two parties put to the British people alternative prospectus and then try to sort of rebut each other's ideas. Ultimately, we need the government to succeed because humanity has an interest in governments and governments around the world succeeding. We all want to see this virus defeated, for it to be sent packing, in the famous words of Boris Johnson 12 weeks ago. Sadly, it hasn't been sent packing. I fear we've got a long, long way to go.
Taking that on board then, that, you know, we all want this to work well, how much blame do you think actually appropriately belongs with the government? And I ask that because lots of people who don't have a dog in this hunt say, look, actually, this was the advice from the scientists, even about the timing of lockdown and so on. And therefore, it's not really fair to blame the political leadership. If you want to blame people, blame SAGE, the scientific advisory group to the government and others. What do you think about that? Where does political blame belong, do you think?
I think the government underestimated the scale and the nature of this pandemic. Even though it was the top of their risk register, even though they'd had dummy exercises in government, and I think they were probably distracted in January and February. You're right, in as much as, you know, the government was listening to scientific advice. But if one looks at some of the papers published by SAGE, SAGE is clear that decisions around lockdown and so on are fundamentally a political decision. And I think the question is, were ministers thorough enough in asking the searching questions of those who were advising them? Because we could see that the UK was following one path, and other countries around the world seem to be going in a very different direction. And one of the issues that emerged was a debate around whether the government were relying too much on behavioural scientists rather than the public health experts. So there's all these curious, odd things in some of the running through some of the justifications at the time. And I think in retrospect, I suspect ministers probably wished they interrogated some of this.
And now the argument is slightly on the other side, suggesting that they are not listening to the scientists enough. Perhaps then they were listening too much. Now they're not listening enough, and they're putting politics, or in some ways economics, first, particularly in this discussion around the appropriate social distance. Should it be 2 metres, which the scientists still seem to say is best, or should it be 1 metre, which obviously economically would be good news for people in the hospitality industry? It would allow restaurants and bars and pubs to become economically viable again. What do you think is the right call the government should be making? Do you think they should go down to 1 metre simply because the economic damage is so awful?
So we know that the economy impacts health. So I don't criticise them for wanting to get the economic questions right. But the issue of the 1 metre versus the 2 metre rule is about a balance of risks. And you could reduce them down to 1 metre if you've got other mitigating factors in place. You probably need a greater use of mask wearing in society. You most certainly need to have a more developed test, trace and isolate regime in place. We simply don't have that at the moment. So I think
given where we are, do you think we've got to stay with 2 meters?
Well, we are staying with 2 meters for the moment. The question is, what will the government decide in a couple of weeks' time when they currently review it? And they will need to assure us that their testing and tracing is in a better place than it has been so far. But we'll have to look at what the government propose, I think, in the beginning of July, which is when I think their review is due to report.
Except that, you see, Keir Starmer, by setting out this idea of constructive opposition, made people expect something slightly different, which is for you not just to wait to see what the government would say and then react to it, but actually to be sort of involved in the process. And a lot of people have been very struck by how at Prime Minister's Questions, Keir Starmer often refers to private dialogue he's been having with the Prime Minister, usually in the form of letters, as if there is a behind-the-scenes channel. I'm interested in your portfolio, which is obviously so central now. Are there conversations like that between you and the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock?
Well, there has been. I mean, there very much was at the start of this, and there's been less direct discussions since then. But we continue to try to be constructive. We continue to make suggestions. And there have been a number of occasions when government has adopted our proposals.
Well, I'm going to come on to one of those in a moment. But when you say the contact is less, does that mean you're sending notes to him, sending text messages to him, and what? Are they not really responding the way they should?
I think in fairness, I mean, if I need to speak to Matt Hancock, he doesn't ignore me. He does respond. But and when we have asked for briefings from the chief medical officer and things of that nature, they have provided them. But I think the idea that there's some sort of, you know, regular sort of committee meeting, I mean, no, nothing like that happens.
One big success for the opposition and opponents on the backbenchers as well was the U-turn that the government executed on the notion of charging migrants to this country a surcharge to use the NHS, and that surcharge being levied even on people who work in the NHS and in care. Big, lots of noise at the time, but survey work by the Doctors Association now suggests that actually doctors are still having to pay this surcharge. So maybe this was a victory superficially, but substantively the problem remains.
Yes, it does. And it's funny enough, I've been discussing this just today with Yvette Cooper, as you know, is the chair of the Home Affairs Select Committee, who's been raising this very issue this week, but also raising the broader point that not only are doctors, as you say, still have to pay it, but low-paid health and care workers still have to pay it. And we're talking about how we can push the government further on this. So you're right to raise this. And this is one of the things that really sort of angers me about this government, not in the context of coronavirus, but more generally. It feels to me like a very press release-driven government, very much a headline-chasing government. Perhaps that is not unexpected, given the leader of it, Boris Johnson, and his most senior sort of cabinet colleague, Michael Gove, former journalists themselves. But it seems that they are into grabbing the short-term headlines to get themselves out of a tight spot, but never actually following through with the detailed delivery.
And for that reason, it's possible that by the time people hear this conversation you and I are having, they may have U-turned on the U-turn and actually then implement the NHS surcharge that is still standing. And the reason why I say that is, as you and I speak now, they have U-turned in the last few hours on the question of the continuation of free school meals through vouchers during the summer holidays, bowing to the popular demand raised by the Manchester United footballer Marcus Rashford. What should people think? Perhaps people who are sort of neutrals in this, should we admire a government that does U-turn like this because it shows they're flexible and open to negotiation? I mean, does that fill you as an opposition spokesperson with some confidence because it means you, with the right pressure, you can nudge them? Or do you think we should worry about having a government that, whether you're a Conservative supporter or not, is too weak to actually hold the line?
Well, I think the question is, do they follow through on it? Because there are a number of commitments and promises that this government has made, and they never, or they don't fully follow through. They promised to get laptops and computers to the poorest pupils who, you know, because they're not going to school. They haven't delivered on it. Boris Johnson, when in a corner in the House of Commons, promised to be testing 250,000 people a day. He's not delivered on it. We've been promised a world-beating testing and tracing strategy, while at the same time, the private company running it, Serco, admits it won't be fully rolled out until September. They make big grand promises, but they never seem to follow through on the detail. And I suppose the worry today is that, will they actually follow through? Will parents be getting these vouchers at the end of July to feed their children throughout the summer? Will it be late again? Will there be some problem with the system? It just seems that they want to get the headline because they fight things on a day-by-day basis. They're very driven by focus groups, but they're always trying to chase headlines rather than actually follow through on the detailed work. And you see that, I think, in the mishandling of their response to coronavirus.
Let's just talk about racism in our closing few minutes. Earlier this week, the Shadow Justice Secretary, David Lammy, was scathing about the decision by the Prime Minister to initiate a new review. He said, we've already got one, we don't need one. He was annoyed about Munira Mirza as chair. What are your thoughts about that announcement of another commission to look into racism in Britain?
It felt like a short-termist headline-grabbing move from the Prime Minister, from Boris Johnson, to try and get himself out of a corner. And I thought David Lammy, who was on the radio yesterday, spoke with tremendous power and eloquence when he made the point that this was buried in a broader article, which was a sort of straw man argument about pulling down this statue of Winston Churchill outside Parliament. No political party here is proposing to pull down the statue of Winston Churchill outside Parliament. We know that this is a very, very serious issue. We know that Black, Asian, minority, ethnic people face systemic racism, which affects educational outcomes, affects employment opportunities, which in turn impacts on health outcomes. There are a number of serious measures that have to be taken, which plenty of reviews have proposed. There's some good suggestions in the Public Health England report, which has finally today been published in full. What is needed is the government to get on with it. So I think David Lammy, in making that point, makes a very persuasive and powerful point. We just need the government to get on with it.
Last thing to put to you. Last week on Politics Weekly, my colleague Joseph Harker predicted that the, as he put it, the civil servant in Sir Keir Starmer, you know, the former DPP, would prevent him from going all the way on the issue of racism in Britain. He wouldn't demand almost the revolutionary change that is actually needed and would be too cautious, lacking perhaps the sort of fire we heard from David Lammy the other day. What's your view on that and whether Labour actually needs to be much stronger to meet the scale of this moment?
I think we will meet the scale of this moment because Keir Starmer, like me, like all the Shadow Cabinet, passionate and determined to confront these health inequalities that we see in society. A baby born right this second in a poorer area, particularly if they're born into a Black, Asian, or minority ethnic community, is on average likely to live around 9-10 years less than a baby born right this second in a wealthier area. And that child born in the poorer area is more likely to leave school obese, is less likely to get the immunisations that they need, is more likely to turn or need the support of child and adolescent mental health services, and is more likely as an adult to suffer from diabetes or blood pressure. I mean, poverty and deprivation affects people's life chances, and racism in turn contributes to that poverty and deprivation. So I think the Labour Party is pretty passionate about dealing with these things because it's the reason we're in the Labour Party in the first place.
Jonathan Ashworth, thanks very much for coming on Politics Weekly.
Pleasure.
That's all from us this week. For anyone wanting to hear a deep dive into how Keir Starmer's leadership has gone so far, Heather Stewart spoke to Anushka Asthana for today's episode of The Guardian's daily podcast, Today in Focus. So look out for that wherever you get your podcasts. A huge thanks to all of our guests, Frances Perrodin, Lisa O'Carroll and Jonathan Ashworth. The producer is Danielle Stevens. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Please do take care of yourselves. And thanks, as always, for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.